Kim is committed to going to zero. He's just going in the opposite direction, and that's really hard to understand if he's sincere.
The United States cautious following latest Korea summit. It's Friday, September 21st. This is VOA Asia. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. We're also on Facebook at VOA Asia. Coming up, opinions vary on U.S. trade tactics. Investigations wrap up on Myanmar. Japan asserts strength above and below the water. A supreme battle raging in Washington and a digital-free Iceland. It's all on today's VOA Asia. Before returning to Seoul Thursday, South Korean President Moon Jae-in joined North Korean leader Kim Jong-un in a show of unity by capping their three-day summit with a visit to the symbolic North Korean volcano of Mount Paektu near the China border. Wednesday, North Korean leader Kim Jong-un pledged to dismantle key missile facilities and close its main nuclear complex if Washington took reciprocal actions. President Donald Trump and Secretary of State Mike Pompeo praised the offer. Pompeo invited his North Korea counterpart to talks on the sidelines of next week's UN General Assembly and called for delegations from both countries to sit down in Vienna, headquarters of the International Atomic Energy Agency. The top diplomat said Washington was ready to engage immediately in negotiations for the North's complete denuclearization by January 2021. That's the end of Mr. Trump's first term. Bruce Bennett, senior defense analyst at the RAND Corporation, tells VOA's Victor Beatty, shutting down the Yongbyon nuclear reactor would likely take longer than other aspects of the North's denuclearization.
To collect up all of North Korea's nuclear weapons and disable his production capabilities, you could do that in a year or so, I would expect. The problem, of course, is that Kim Jong-un, at this stage, hasn't done a single meaningful thing to dismantle his nuclear weapons. In fact, he's going the opposite direction. He's making nuclear weapons and increasing his stockpile. And there's really nothing in the summit that's going to stop him from doing that. I think President Moon likely tried as hard as he could, but I don't think Kim Jong-un has decided yet that he really is going to do this. I think he's playing for time.
So you see no significance in the pronouncement of a dismantling of key missile facilities in the eyes of so-called concerned country experts or the closure of the main Yongbyon nuclear complex?
The missile facilities, Kim Jong-un had already talked about dismantling those. This wasn't something new. This was a repeat of something that had already occurred. On the Yongbyon complex, he says, well, I'm prepared to do this if I'm compensated by the Americans. Excuse me? He's already been generously compensated for doing something which he hasn't really done yet. This is a kind of case where, like I say, for many Americans, I think he seems to be stalling. I think he's anxious to build up his nuclear weapons to the point where he can actively coerce the United States and other regional countries. But he's not there yet, and so he's got to delay us taking serious action against him.
Is the U.S. reacting too quickly to this summit?
Oh, no. I think regardless of whether we think that Kim Jong-un is prepared to do what he is obligated and committed to doing, we still ought to try our best to get him to meet his commitments. I mean, he is committed. The April 27th agreement, Kim said he would implement all previous agreements, and one of the previous agreements said he would go to zero nuclear weapons. So Kim is committed to going to zero. He's just going in the opposite direction, and that's really hard to understand if he's sincere.
He's calling for U.S. unspecified actions in return. What might those include?
Oh, I think what he wants is relaxation of the sanctions. That's clear that he wants that. I think he wants diplomatic recognition, but probably most important is a peace agreement. He wants a peace agreement, I believe, because he wants to undermine the basis for U.S. troops in Korea. You know, he knows he could do that bilaterally with President Moon of South Korea tomorrow. President Moon would sign a peace agreement with him, but that doesn't get him what he wants. What he wants is the U.S. to sign a peace agreement so that then China and Russia can go to the U.N. and say, see, the U.S. signed a peace agreement. There's no longer a need for a U.N. command in Korea. All of the U.S. forces that are in Korea don't need to be there because there's peace now.
Bruce Bennett said he believes part of the North's strategy is to drive a wedge between allies, South Korea and the United States. With the two Koreas drawing closer economically, involving possible violations of Security Council resolutions, Bruce Bennett said that will further undermine President Trump's so-called maximum pressure campaign. And given the lack of real progress on denuclearization, Bennett sees a future U.S.-North Korea summit as unlikely anytime soon. These are among some of the top Asia stories you'll find right now when you visit voanews.com. Inter-Korea progress has U.S. ready to resume North Korea talks. At least 12 killed in new Philippine landslide. Laos accused of copy-pasting dam impact survey. Ex-Malaysian Prime Minister hit with 25 new charges in 1MDB looting scandal. Price hikes test once unshakable popularity of Philippine president. Expanded coverage of these stories and much more are found on Facebook at VOA Asia. You can also stop by the voanews.com website. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. We continue now with VOA Asia. The Trump administration's latest tariffs on Chinese imports have been welcomed by some in Washington who have advocated a tougher stance on China's trade practices. But as VOA's Bill Gallo reports, some are also questioning whether the White House is using the right strategy in its trade war with the world's second largest economy.
Can't do that anymore. It should have been done many years ago. It should have been done by other presidents. And actually, it's a disgrace that it wasn't done.
In a way, Donald Trump is doing what many in the United States have long wanted, to get tough on China.
The losses have been staggering for so many years for our country, and we just can't let that happen anymore.
Trump this week announced tariffs on $200 billion in Chinese goods. And as promised, China retaliated with its own tariffs on $60 billion worth of U.S. exports. The move increases fears of an all-out trade war with Beijing. But some in Washington see few alternatives.
I don't want a trade war with China, but there has to be fairness. And I think a very simple concept in life, their businesses should only be allowed to do here what our businesses are allowed to do there. Why wouldn't that be fair? Why wouldn't that be real?
But others are concerned Trump's trade war isn't focused enough. Specifically, they question Trump's steel and aluminum tariffs on U.S. allies, such as Canada, Mexico, and the European Union, countries that could help pressure China.
I'm concerned that President Trump is slapping tariffs on products from close allies in ways that further weaken us in terms of our global trade posture.
The United States just seems to wake up, and there doesn't seem to be any rhyme or reason to what we're doing. It's kind of a ready, fire, aim.
And Trump's trade dispute could have political ramifications. Even though the tariffs are not likely to lead, at least immediately, to dramatically higher prices for American consumers, they're already hurting some of Trump's key supporters, such as farmers in the Midwest who export their products to China.
Because we're a democracy, our political system is set up to be sensitive to the points of view of constituents. And so, the U.S. has an election coming up in November that most likely will be before the next election in China.
Both the Chinese and U.S. tariffs will go into effect September 24th. Bill Gallo, VOA News, Washington.
Happening now in Asia, Britain's Foreign Minister Jeremy Hunt says Myanmar officials should be held responsible for their country's Rohingya crisis before the International Criminal Court. Hunt's comments came after he met with embattled Myanmar leader Aung San Suu Kyi in a high-profile state visit to the country. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We've made it to Friday. We're happier with us on VOA Asia. The International Criminal Court in The Hague has opened a preliminary investigation into the deportations of hundreds of thousands of Rohingya Muslims to Bangladesh from Myanmar, also known as Burma. ICC prosecutor Fatou Bensouda said the investigation will look into alleged coercive acts, including the deprivation of fundamental rights, killings, sexual violence, enforced disappearances, destruction, and looting. The ICC action comes as UN fact-finding mission on Myanmar released a lengthy 440-page report detailing last year's security force crackdown on the Rohingya, including mass killings and gang rapes on a genocidal scale. Monique Skidmore is a professor and deputy vice chancellor at the University of Tasmania in Australia and a Myanmar expert. She tells VOA these two developments are significant in that the international community is now challenging decades of impunity by the Myanmar military.
So we're starting to see in this preliminary investigation by the ICC through the mechanism of cross-deportation, crime of deportation, we're beginning to see the end of Myanmar's impunity. So it's been 60 years now in which the military generals of various kinds have been able to act with impunity. There's been no justice, no recourse to justice, no documentation of the terrible crimes against humanity, of the genocidal killings, and of the state violence that's occurred in Myanmar. And finally now, the UN, the ICC, and the ASEAN parliamentarians have said, enough is enough. Myanmar must be brought to justice, and these particular generals implicated in Rakhine state violence must be tried.
As the ICC is an arm of the UN Security Council, where both Russia and China hold veto power, a concern is the process, that Skidmore notes.
I think China will, as they have historically always done, voted against any action against Myanmar. It's fascinating that the five of the largest countries in ASEAN have come forward to say that they must be investigated. It's a real break with China. It's a break with the idea of political neutrality by ASEAN. But not being a member of the ICC is the biggest stumbling point. Myanmar cannot be tried for all of the crimes that have occurred within Myanmar. It's a relatively long bow to draw to say that it can investigate Myanmar crimes on Bangladeshi soil, because Bangladesh is a signatory to the ICC. But it can only do that by investigating what may have happened to have led them to be deported. So the idea that this might become a full-fledged ICC process in which we might see the warrant for an arrest, for example, of the or the finding guilty of the generals is very difficult to predict that such a thing would happen just at the moment.
Monique Skidmore said the de facto civilian leader, Aung San Suu Kyi, a Nobel laureate who, while under house arrest, was a thorn in the side of the military standing for freedom of the press and railing against the propaganda of the military. Now she said the Myanmar leader has been entirely induced into wrongdoing by the military leadership. Coming up, Japan is making a statement on the high seas. You're listening to VOA Asia.
Do you lead a busy life? Not always able to catch your favorite VOA radio or TV program? If you are keen to stay in touch with world news and events, give VOA podcasts a try.
VOANews.com.
Visit our website at VOANews.com to learn how you can become a subscriber to VOA podcasts and keep your life up to date.
VOA News, your trusted source for news and information.
This news from VOA Asia, a Hong Kong cardinal who has spearheaded opposition to the Vatican's rapprochement with China, called on Thursday for the Pope's Secretary of State to step down, saying any deal with Beijing would amount to a betrayal of the Catholic faith. Visit VOA Asia Facebook each day for top stories and great features. This is VOA Asia. VOA Asia continues. Japan has acknowledged that it carried out its first submarine drill in the disputed South China Sea last week after taking part in joint exercises with a U.S. Navy carrier strike group. A separate freedom of navigation mission was conducted this month by a British warship. China has claimed sovereignty over most of the vital South China Sea, but its claims have been challenged by other Asian nations, and its position was undermined by a UN ruling 2 years ago. U.S. Defense Secretary Jim Mattis has criticized Beijing for intimidation and coercion following reports China has deployed jamming technology, anti-ship cruise missiles, surface-to-air missiles, and heavy bombers to its outposts in the South China Sea. Stephen Nagy, senior associate professor at the Tokyo-based International Christian University, tells VOA Japan's naval presence shows its commitment to a free and open Indo-Pacific strategy.
And by contributing to joint training with the United States in the South China Sea, contributing submarines, it's a vivid example to the Trump administration that Japan's on board, it's willing to exert leadership and expend some valuable resources to check China's assertive behavior in the South China Sea.
The submarine drill is thought to be the first Japan has carried out since the end of the Second World War, and Nagi says there's more attached to it.
I think this is significant because it's been announced by the Ministry of Defense, and it's been announced in a way that suggests that that Japan itself is decidedly committed to having a leadership role in this free and open Pacific strategy. And I think it's important that Japan is taking a leading role because it has been in the shadows of late with the North Korean issues and with the trade war. And I think it gives Japan this opportunity to demonstrate that it's committed not only to the rhetoric but to action.
This comes a short time after Japanese warships took part in drills in the South China Sea with a U.S. Navy Ronald Reagan carrier strike group. British Royal Navy amphibious assault ship the HMS Albion also sailed close to islands that China claims, all of which is likely upsetting to the government in Beijing.
China's not going to be happy with what's happening in the South China Sea. They've claimed the entirety, what they call the nine-dash line of the South China Sea, it looks like a cow's tongue, to be their lake in the Pacific. And they're going to be increasingly upset that it's not only the Japanese working with the United States, but extra-regional powers such as Britain coming in. We also have the French coming in and other countries that are saying, listen, China, you need to follow international law. You need to go back to the Permanent Court of Arbitration's decision in July 2016. You need to demonstrate that you're going to follow international law and not be a revisionist power within the region. And they're going to see these activities as a part of a larger containment strategy to keep China down, to push back against China's expansionism, and to complicate life both internationally and domestically for Beijing.
The Japanese submarine Kurushio is finishing a five-day port of call to Vietnam's strategic naval base at Cameron Bay. Stephen Nagy said it shows countries in the region that other nations are prepared to push back at China's growing assertiveness. This news from VOA Asia, a coalition of groups fighting to protect the Mekong, say an official impact assessment for a controversial new Lao Dam has been directly copied and pasted in parts from a previous project. They say the text is from a 2015 assessment for a different project found to be inaccurate. You'll find accuracy every day when you visit VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, the U.S. Senate remains divided over the fate of Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh, who has denied an allegation by Christine Blasey Ford that he sexually assaulted her when they were teenagers back in the 1980s. Ford and opposition Democrats are demanding an FBI investigation into the alleged assault before she would testify before the Senate Judiciary Committee, while President Donald Trump and Senate Republicans are so far resisting. More now on the battle over Kavanaugh's nomination from VOA national correspondent Jim Malone.
President Trump is standing by his Supreme Court nominee, Judge Brett Kavanaugh.
This is a very tough thing for him and his family. And we want to get it over with. At the same time, we want to give tremendous amounts of time. If she shows up, that would be wonderful. If she doesn't show up, that would be unfortunate.
Professor Christine Blasey Ford has been invited to testify Monday before the Senate Judiciary Committee. But Ford first wants the FBI to investigate her allegation that Kavanaugh sexually assaulted her when they were teenagers in the 1980s. Ford has the support from Senate Democrats, including Kirsten Gillibrand of New York.
The fact that she has to protect her children from death threats and this kind of assertions online about her, I think, is exactly why survivors of sexual violence do not come forward.
Law professor Anita Hill is also among those calling for a full investigation. In 1991, Hill accused then-Supreme Court nominee Clarence Thomas of sexual misconduct, though Thomas was eventually confirmed by a narrow margin.
There is no reason for them to rush this and push this in with a six-day time frame. The American public really is expecting something more. The American public wants to know about what happened. And they want to know that the Senate takes this seriously.
Republicans have complained that the Ford allegation came after lengthy and contentious hearings where Kavanaugh was questioned by senators from both parties. South Dakota Republican Senator John Thune.
There have been 1,300 written questions that have been responded to by Judge Kavanaugh, and he met with 65 United States senators over the course of the last 2 months, and never a whiff of this letter until just this last week.
Republican Senator Lisa Murkowski says it's important that both Ford and Kavanaugh be heard.
My hope is that it will be conducted with a level of respect and integrity for the process and for the people.
You believe the allegations are credible?
I think that is exactly why we have this process.
The controversy has now put Kavanaugh's nomination, a lifetime appointment to the Supreme Court, in jeopardy, says legal analyst Paul Schiff Berman.
And I think that this accusation will solidify the Democratic opposition to Kavanaugh's nomination. And given the fact that Republicans hold only a small majority in the Senate, the defection of just a small number of Republican senators would defeat this nomination.
Kavanaugh was nominated to replace retired Justice Anthony Kennedy. His confirmation would solidify a conservative majority on the Supreme Court. Jim Malone, VOA News, Washington.
There's a push to keep a remote Icelandic nature reserve free from any internet or phone signals to preserve the area's tranquility. But not everyone is on board with the proposed digital free zone, as we hear from VOA correspondent Mariama Diallo.
In this remote Icelandic nature reserve, there is little to no mobile phone service. A local park ranger has to climb a mountain to make a phone call, and he's not always successful.
My phone is just receiving one bar. Not enough for a phone call. Maybe the clouds are interfering a little bit or something.
But internet service could soon reach the isolated reserve, a possibility that has most hikers, park rangers, and summer residents worried.
People have had a difficult time being disconnected from the internet, but I think most people enjoy the fact that they're disconnected from it and they feel a difference when they're here.
The area has long resisted cell towers, but commercial initiatives could push the reserve across the digital divide.
If there was internet, would it be hard to resist it? Of course, people would be hanging with their phones in their hands, carrying big battery packs, taking map, which is, you should have paper version anyways.
There are no roads leading to the reserve. It's accessible only by boat. And while some welcome the proposed free digital zone, others warn that restricting access to cellular services could prove reckless.
Traveling without cell phone access has its charm, of course, but there's nothing romantic about lying on the ground with a broken thigh bone, unable to call for help.
And for this summer resident, not having cell access meant vacationing without one family member.
My teenage daughter refused to come this year. Leaving the 4G world and being without internet was too much for her.
Iceland ranks number one on a UN index comparing nations' information technology use, with roughly 98% of the population using the internet. But residents will now have to decide whether they want to remain digitally connected at all times or stay off the grid while visiting some areas. Mariama Diallo, VOA News.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. In most places in Asia and around the world, you can hear our program on a mobile phone, a great way to hear us. You can also hear us on the radio, U-Radio of Hatcha University, FM 101.25 at Hatcha University in Thailand. We always thank everyone there who's tuned in today and wherever you've been listening. We also like to thank our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Keith Holmes, managing editor, Diane Gao, and our VOA Asia team. It includes Skylar Ogden, Ira Melman, and Doug Bernard. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. We hope you have a nice day.